It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover as usual, starting with local and our state budget.
Yeah, this week, Senator Joe Zarelli, Republican senator in the Washington State Legislature, he introduced what the Republicans referred to as another compromise budget, which means that the Republicans...
Even though they didn't actually compromise with anybody, they developed it themselves behind closed doors and then presented it.
Yeah, and they discussed it with approximately three conservative Democrats. The main differences between this new budget proposal and the one that they passed before is that it trades the cuts in school funding that the Republicans had proposed earlier for a limited charter, a so-called limited charter school program. I should note here that Governor Gregoire said that she would veto any bill that contains a charter school program in it. It also, this new proposal, doesn't cut the temporary assistance for needy families like the earlier version of the Republican budget did, but it still eliminates Disability Lifeline. That's the program that makes small payments to folks who live in the state of Washington who are severely disabled and simply can't work but don't qualify for Social Security benefits. This new budget proposal also includes a four-year balanced budget amendment, which would lock the legislature into limited spending regardless of what the economy does in the next 4 years. It also includes a constitutional debt limit, a repeal of the voter-mandated but unfunded smaller class size initiatives that passed, and the teacher pay raises that passed the voters a while back. And then it also would take over health care plans from school districts and make that a state plan, which I find kind of interesting because the Republicans are all about decentralization and smaller government. Yeah, but in this case, apparently not. And then it also includes a pension reform plan that delays $140 million, making a payment of $140 million into the state pension fund, which I think is the craziest thing that they could be doing. I mean, there are cities and counties all over the United States that are facing bankruptcy largely because of underfunded pension plans. And for the state Republicans to propose that now in this year really shows that they know nothing about economics and nothing about really truly balancing the budget.
Yeah, they've also got about five or six things in there, starting with Disability Lifeline. And also with the repeal of the teacher, of the class size initiative that are just deal breakers for Democrats. There's no way that the Democratic House is going to sign off on it. There's no way that Christine Gregoire would not veto it. And they know that this is a non-starter. That's why it's an offer that was not negotiated with the Democrats ahead of time, or even shown to the Democrats or the governor ahead of time. And that's why it's going to go nowhere. The strategy here by the Democrats basically is to not negotiate. What they are doing is saying, you know, because the Republican budget in the state Senate was dropped into the process at the very last possible moment, because it was done without any public hearings, without any advance notice, the public hasn't been familiar with the specifics of it, and the longer that the time goes on and the more that people see the specifics of it, the angrier they're getting. And so the Democrats know that time is on their side, and that although there's a cost to the special session as it keeps on going day after day, that the Democrats' negotiating position gets stronger as time goes on and the Republicans gets weaker, just because what the Republicans are proposing is extremely unpopular.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. On to Kemper Freeman.
Yeah, this week Kemper Freeman lost in court. He sued a while back to block Sound Transit from using the lanes on I-90. He said that I-90 was built with gas tax money, therefore it must be used for automobile traffic only. The state Supreme Court was where he filed his first suit, tried to take it to them. They threw the case back to a lower court saying, look, you can't go straight to us. You got to have a lower court hear this and rule on it first. Freeman then filed suit in Kittitas County, thinking that he'd get a sympathetic judge there.
That's Ellensburg for people who
yes.
don't know their geography.
Yes, which also makes you think maybe the judge was scratching his head saying, why am I hearing this? Well, the Kittitas County Superior Court Judge Michael Cooper ruled that Sound Transit can use lanes on I-90 because they'll be reimbursing the State Department of Transportation for new carpool lanes that will be built to replace the center lanes of I-90 that Sound Transit will be using. And in addition, voters agreed to this deal when they passed the ballot measure for the expansion of Sound Transit back in 2008. So not only did the judge rule that it was okay for Sound Transit to go ahead and that Freeman didn't have any basis for suing, he also, the voters have agreed to it. And so Kemper Freeman bringing a lawsuit trying to trump the voters, that just doesn't look good. Also, the judge cited the fact that federal and state governments the federal and our state government have made multiple past agreements that assume that mass transit will run on I-90. And if the federal government said that, yes, that's going ahead, and the state government said, yes, that's going ahead, and the voters said, yes, that's going ahead, having one guy, a developer in Bellevue, try to trump that makes no sense at all.
For people who aren't familiar, Freeman is the owner of Bellevue Square, among other developments in Bellevue, very fanatically pro-car. And, you know, if he
wants... Anti-transit.
Well, he's anti-transit because he's pro-car. He's also backed in the past a number of other things around expansion of 405 and trying to expand highway capacity.
Yeah, he's tried at the expense of
public transit.
He's tried to defeat the state's efforts to put any kind of money into transit so that money can go towards expanding traffic lanes for automobiles.
Yeah, if he really wants to throw away money on legal fees, I've got a great idea for him.
What's
that? I think he could sue to have greenhouse gases not create climate change.
He could try, yeah.
Yeah, that I think that'd be a fine use of his money.
All right. Moving on. Update on pink slime.
Yes, a local blogger for, I believe it was the Seattle Times or the Seattle PI, I don't remember which, had written a little piece about pink slime in the school lunch program. Well, after reading that, the State Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction here in the state of Washington contacted her, and they said, oh no, there's no pink slime in Washington schools. For folks who don't recall or didn't hear the program last week, pink slime is its trade name is lean, finely textured beef. You could, I guess, technically say it's beef because it's parts from a cow, but it's connective tissue, not the muscle tissue that you would commonly refer to as meat. So this non-meat product, which would in the past have been sent to a rendering plant or put into dog food rather than into human food, the USDA news came out last week that the USDA had purchased 7 million pounds of it to put into the school lunch programs all over the country. Well, the state contacted the local blogger and said, well, no, there's no pink slime in Washington schools.
Mike, you really need to have that laugh track ready for segments like this.
Yes, because...
we're working on it.
Because King's Processing, the main distributor of meat to schools in the state of Washington, they have sent us a letter saying that they don't use it. Well, then, a day later, after the blogger came back and asked the Office of Public Instruction, well, geez, do you always purchase from the same supplier? Well, then the head of the superintendent of public instruction said, well, no, we really don't know for sure whether there's pink slime in the school lunch program in Washington because, yes, school districts can choose to purchase their meat from other meat processors than King's Processing. However, this week, the USDA said that schools will now be allowed to buy from suppliers who don't use pink slime and that suppliers will be required to tell school districts whether or not they actually use lean, finely textured beef as a filler product in the beef that they sell them.
So that's a good thing, at least there's some transparency.
Yeah. Now there's a little bit of transparency. The main point, though, is that there ought to be better labeling for people who go to the supermarket as well and buy ground beef and not know whether or not it has pink slime in it.
Yeah, and I'm just flashing back to like third grade and all the jokes we used to make about what was actually in the cafeteria food. We had no idea that those jokes were true.
Well, they probably weren't when you were a kid, Jeff. Nowadays, when if you're a kid, those jokes really are. They do have a painful grain of truth in them.
All right, so we're pushing for transparency with pink slime.
Oh, yes, yes. Ooh, if you're going to feed us waste product, let us know it's in there.
Great, translucent pink slime.
All right, let's move on. Boeing, always making news, but...
Yes, Boeing announced this week that it won't produce the 787-9 horizontal tails in Seattle, so tails for its 787-9 plane that they're developing to replace the Dreamliner. Now, yes, they are developing the 787-9 here in the state of Washington. However, they said as soon as they get the processing figured out, the manufacturing figured out, they're going to move those jobs to Salt Lake City. And then they went on to say, well, yeah, once we ramp up production, we're going to need a bigger facility than the one in Salt Lake City. So instead of hiring expensive workers here in the United States, they're going to send the jobs overseas to the plant in Italy. Alenia, the plant in Italy that they've been using for other manufacturing for Boeing airplanes, has had a lot of problems with quality control issues. And the fact that Boeing is thinking of continuing to use them again really shows you that Boeing doesn't particularly care about the quality of its products, nor about jobs here in the United States or jobs here in Washington State. They're more concerned with their bottom line, just like any big corporation.
And it also underscores once again that Boeing jobs fleeing the state of Washington is not about high taxes or not getting sufficient tax breaks. It's about the cost of labor.
Yes,
and it's
exactly.
And it's about punishing and trying to destroy unions.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, at least they are consistent in that. All right, let's move on. Jay Inslee.
Yeah, Jay Inslee announcing last weekend that he would resign from his U.S. House of Representatives seat in order to continue his campaign for governor. This is kind of a departure from the norm. It's fairly common for House of Representatives members to be running for higher office, either the Senate or a governorship or whatever. Very rarely do they actually resign in order to do the campaign. And the same reason that Inslee cited as why he was resigning is usually cited as the reason why people don't resign, which is that in an election year, and particularly if you're in the minority party, when the majority party isn't particularly interested in bipartisanship, there's not a whole lot to do over the spring and summer in the House of Representatives. Having not a whole lot to do, Inslee obviously wanting to avoid the 3,000-mile each way commute once or twice a week, but that's understandable. The problem with that is that Rob McKenna, his Republican opponent, is currently the Washington State Attorney General. He is not resigning from his seat, and it enables him to draw a clear contrast with Inslee as somebody who didn't serve out his term, and McKenna as somebody who is serving out his term, even though he, like Inslee, probably wouldn't be doing a whole lot with his day job during the time when he's campaigning. So it's a very mixed blessing. It gives Inslee more time on the campaign trail, but it also opens up to charges that he is a Palin-esque quitter. Not that, you know, McKenna would invoke Sarah Palin as something, anything other than, you know, somebody to emulate, But it's a peculiar move by Jay Inslee. Now, if people are wondering, the seat will not be filled until the November election. There are a number of people who are running in the first district, but they keep a skeleton staff on in Washington D.C. even when the seat is open in a case like this, so the constituent service can still continue.
Hmm. So, how does voting take place then? I mean, how is?
What do you mean?
If he's not there.
He doesn't vote.
He doesn't vote.
So the Democrats lose a vote.
Some of the Democrats lose a vote. I mean, they're already in the minority, so that doesn't really matter that much.
All right. Okay, so we're skipping national this week. You didn't see anything on the national radar?
No, we just been complaining about the Republican presidential campaign.
All right, then we're moving on to
the clown trail. Yeah.
Right. Then we're moving on to international, starting with Afghanistan.
Yeah, this week's massacre in Afghanistan, U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Robert Bales walked, supposedly, this is the Army narrative,
which has always been so accurate when it's been released in instances like this in the past.
Yeah, the Army narrative is that he walked off the base in the middle of the night after having a few beers with some buddies, took a weapon with him, killed 16 Afghan civilians, 9 of whom were children, the youngest a baby, and at least 4 of them were younger than 6. He gathered together about 11 of the bodies in one house and set them on fire in order to try to, hide the evidence. And then apparently he walked back to the base and surrendered his weapon and told everybody what he had done. Now, there were contradictions in this narrative from the beginning. One is the very first contradiction is that a number of witnesses in the villages themselves said that, no, we didn't see just one guy. We saw helicopters and we saw multiple men with weapons. In addition, the Army was saying, well, yes, Bales was trained as a sniper, but he was also part of a village stabilization operation. Village stabilization operations are commonly run not by the U.S. Army, but by Green Berets, who are there to meet with the local village elders and set up a village militia or neighborhood watch.
In other words, hearts and minds kind of stuff.
Yeah, not something that you would necessarily think a sniper would be useful for. Typically, snipers are useful in heavy combat situations or frontline situations where you need to take out someone from a distance. So it was a little bit confusing to me for them to say, well, he was a sniper, he wasn't a Green Beret, but he was part of this village stabilization operation. Now, in addition, they said some other things about him, too. Well, you know, he was having marital problems and he just snapped. Well, we hear later from his lawyer that, no, there's nothing wrong with Bales's marriage. The problems that he was having at home had to do with their finances. This was his fourth deployment. He'd been through 3 deployments in Iraq, and then he was told by the military that he would not be deployed overseas again. And then suddenly, almost overnight, they told him, yes, we're sending you to Afghanistan. This is in spite of the fact that he and his family were having financial problems. He and his wife were underwater on the home that they owned and were having to sell it because he wasn't able to be home enough to make enough money for them to make the mortgage payments. In addition, the military said, well, he had a mild head wound while he was in Iraq, but he was cleared for active duty afterwards. Well, it turns out that he'd had at least one head wound, possibly 2, that he'd also lost part of a foot in an explosion, that the military said, well, the head wound he had received was a non-combat one. Well, now we hear that it was indeed a combat one in which his vehicle that he was traveling in Iraq was turned over because of a roadside explosion from a roadside explosive device, something that you would consider a combat wound. So, you know, there's a lot of contradictions here, and we're obviously not getting the truth.
Yeah, there's a number of other things that are sort of fishy about this.
Yes.
One is that this is the latest in a number of instances of wanton brutality that come from soldiers that have been trained at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Now, part of that is that a lot of the combat troops in Afghanistan and previously in Iraq come from Lewis-McChord. But, you know, the kill teams that were recently convicted came from Afghanistan. There have been a number of rapes. There have been a number of suicides of returning soldiers that have come from Lewis-McChord. And it really calls into question what sort of training and what sort of dehumanization is going on at Lewis-McChord. There have been a number of reports in the past that the management mm-hmm. of Lewis-McChord is very, very troubled.
Yeah. In addition, there are reports from soldiers who've tried to get treatment for PTSD at Madigan, the Army Medical Center on or near the base, that there are problems with that diagnosis at Madigan. There's pressure from the superiors in order to doctor charts or to not give that diagnosis for soldiers who are obviously troubled by having been deployed more than once combat situations. In this case, Bales was on his fourth deployment, which is generally when you tend to find problems with PTSD among soldiers, a much higher rate of PTSD.
Particularly people who have had wounds.
Yeah, a much higher rate of PTSD among guys in their third or fourth deployments than you would find in their first or second deployment. In addition, he had been in Iraq, and Iraq in many ways is a much better combat zone than Afghanistan. Iraq is a country with some infrastructure. It's got a relatively educated population, and at least half of the population wants you there, the Shiite half. In Afghanistan, that is not the case at all. You're sending guys from Iraq to Afghanistan. They're going into a situation, as I pointed out earlier, the village stabilization operation that that Bales was supposed to be part of. I really think that's more a moniker to make it sound like we're not in full combat mode still in Afghanistan, when I think we probably really are still in full combat mode in a country that has no infrastructure, a relatively uneducated population, the bulk of which don't want us there and don't understand why we're there.
Yeah, the other thing that was very interesting about this whole incident is the response to it in Afghanistan and in the United States. The immediate assumption in the United States is that there are going to be massive demonstrations in Afghanistan. This is going to be a very difficult situation. Of course, this is coming right on the heels of the demonstrations about the Quran. And when those demonstrations didn't materialize, you saw some commentaries along the line of, see, they can get all riled up about this book, but human life is cheap. They don't really care about that. Well, no, that's not actually the problem. The problem is that there weren't massive demonstrations about this because this sort of thing has been going on in Afghanistan routinely. The difference is that rather than the public narrative anyway of a lone soldier, which as Maria outlined, there are a number of reasons to be suspicious of that narrative, but mass deaths of civilians have been happening routinely in Afghanistan for a decade. The wedding parties, the children,
Just the week before, a U.S. military night raid had killed a number of civilians. So, I mean, this is, as Jav said, it's a weekly occurrence. So this week's massacre in Afghanistan isn't going to spark the huge demonstrations that burning the Quran did.
Yeah, and again, the people in the United States draw a distinction between what a soldier did when he didn't have orders to do it and what soldiers do when they do have orders to do it. Mm-hmm. But Afghans really don't care about that because from their standpoint, there are these Westerners who are occupying their country and killing civilians, and it really doesn't matter whether it's under individual initiative or official orders.
So one of the responses it did elicit from the U.S. was for Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta to visit there.
Yeah, Leon Panetta visited this week, and it was interesting how this visit was reported in the U.S. media versus the British media. Now his airplane landed at a British base there, Camp Bastion, which is connected to or nearby the U.S. base, and there was a tent set up for Panetta to go in and talk to U.S. coalition and Afghan partners to sort of give a little speech about how this isn't going to set us back any, et cetera. Well, there was an attack on Panetta, and the way it was reported in the U.S. media is that Panetta's plane was circling, was about to land, and some random Afghani civilian managed to steal a truck and somehow wrestle a barrel full of incendiary inflammable liquid on into the back of the truck and then drive it past the U.S. military and onto the runway and crash it in an attack on Panetta, but that his plane was then diverted. Now that's not true. In the British press, it was widely reported of what actually happened. Panetta's plane landed. He had got off the plane. He was walking on the runway when an Afghan, a member of the Afghan personnel who was employed on the base drove a truck. This was a planned incident, drove the truck onto the runway in an attempt to try to attack Panetta.
I'm shocked that we wouldn't get the straight story from the U.S. military.
Yeah. And then the truck crashed, and Panetta's handlers, his bodyguards, hustled him out of there. Now, then they sent a U.S. Army spokesman over to the tent where personnel were waiting to hear Panetta come in and give a speech. And they made everybody, he said, okay, everybody, you have to get up, file outside, check your weapons, and then you can come back in without your weapons. And all of the U.S. military personnel looked at each other and said, why do we have to go outside? Usually it's only the Afghanis who have to go outside and check their weapons.
Yeah, because they can't be trusted to occupy their own country.
Yeah. So I found that very, very revealing. First, the fact that that wasn't mentioned in the U.S. press. It was mentioned in the British press. And that we were told that Panetta wasn't anywhere near. His plane hadn't even landed when, in fact, yes, it had, and he was nearby. I found that all very interesting and very revealing about what our real status there in Afghanistan is.
Well, and also the quality of information that we get from the U.S. military and how credulously it is reported in mainstream media in this
media.
Country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without any questions.
All right. Just a few minutes left. Cover issues starting with antibiotics resistance.
Yeah, the Director General of the World Health Organization this week, Margaret Chan, she gave a speech in a scientific meeting this week where she said that we are now entering an era like that was that's very similar to the pre-antibiotic era in terms of antibiotic resistance. That the use of antibiotics in the food supply, particularly the fact that more antibiotics are given to livestock in the world than are given to humans, have created massive antibiotic resistance among humans to some of the most commonly treated illnesses that we take for granted, the fact that we can go to a doctor and get an antibiotic to treat bacterial strep, for example. Well, strep throat could become another lethal infection once antibiotic resistance has spread worldwide. And she also pointed out, too, that it's not cost-effective for private companies to develop new antibiotics when they know that those antibiotics will soon become ineffective because it will take only a matter of a couple of years before they can recoup. You know, it takes many years for drug companies to recoup the cost of having produced a new drug. But if in a couple of years resistance to that antibiotic is widespread and the drug is useless, then it's not cost effective for them to develop it. In addition, what she didn't point out, but what's also true about pharmaceutical companies, is that they would much rather have you take a pill that you have to take every day for the rest of your life than take a pill for 2 weeks to cure an infection. So that raises the issue of whether or not we ought to have a public initiative to discover and develop new antibiotics.
Yeah, it really is pretty sobering to realize that treatment regimens for a number of the world's diseases are being driven not by medical necessity but by the profit potential of drug companies.
All right. Syria.
Yeah, this week the Pentagon admitted to the press that yes, we are considering military action in Syria, not just what the Obama administration has said, oh, we are only considering the humanitarian options. Well, a Pentagon spokesman also said that yes, any humanitarian option we consider in Syria also means that it would have to be preceded by several weeks of heavy U.S. Aerial strikes. In other words, heavy U.S. aerial bombing.
All right. Iran.
Yeah. Mohammad Javad Lirajani, the Secretary General of Iran's Human Rights Council and a key foreign policy advisor to Ayatollah Khomeini, was quoted this week as saying the West should sell Iran 20% enriched uranium and provide the help that nuclear nations are supposed to provide for a nuclear energy program and then for civilian nuclear power plants. In return, for the cooperation from the West, Iran would then offer full transparency and permanent international monitors for its nuclear program. This is exactly what the West has been demanding, and so it raises a couple of issues. One is that whether the United States and the Gang of Six and, of course, Israel, which is driving the bus on a lot of this, are willing to take yes for an answer. And secondly, as Maria said, why didn't we hear about any of this in Western and particularly U.S. media? And the answer to that is because nothing that Iran or its leaders say is taken seriously here without being vetted first and chin-stroked first by Western experts, that their statements are simply not allowed to stand on their own for what they are.
All right. Events.
Yeah. Yeah, several of them. You have a couple of minutes to get to the U District for an outstanding series of workshops and talks today. Lessons from Fukushima for the Northwest, being keynoted, as you may have heard, at 7:30 by Dr. Helen Caldicott. Many others also speaking. That's at United Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. And then Thursday, the 22nd at 7 o'clock, ACLU of Washington doing a forum on safe and just policing toward a police culture beyond the war on drugs with former Seattle Police Chief Norman Snapper. That is free, although donations will be requested, and that is at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca.
Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org is where people find Eat the State.
And you can find more of my material at mariatomczyk.com.